Hello, and welcome to the Game Audio Hour, episode 244. This is a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio, from creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets. Here is where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. It's good to have you back. Thank you for tuning in. My name is Alex May, and I'm joined here today by Michael Gordon Shapiro. How are you, Mike?
I am doing splendidly. How about yourself?
I'm doing pretty well. We actually, since recording the last episode, we've actually had the Eurovision Song Contest final here in Europe. Are you a huge fan of the old Eurovision, Mike?
I'm not a fan, but for the first time, I did a little bit of history research and learning a little bit about Eurovision and some of the acts that emerged from it over the years. So I think I was more aware of the competition this year than in prior years. Okay. Or how about yourself?
Well, I'm Australian, which means I'm somehow, for some strange reason, it is mandatory for me to be like a complete fanboy of Eurovision. For whatever reason, in my country, we just grew up with Eurovision. It's so, I don't know, I think that style of slightly campy, tongue-in-cheek, but also kind of faux serious entertainment appeals to Australian people. And so, it's a bit of an institution in Australia, Eurovision, and everybody loves it, or at least in my generation they did. And so now that I'm living in Sweden, it's only sort of a natural progression for me to be very, very invested. Actually, Sweden is one of the countries in Europe where Eurovision is extremely popular. We have something called Melodifestivalen, which translates as the Melody Festival. And that is basically like a sort of, you know, America's Got Talent, X Factor style talent show, which chooses Sweden's representative at Eurovision. So it's all a very big deal here. Yeah. So, since moving here, it's just only been sort of a natural transition into getting into viewing Eurovision from the other side of the ocean. And, not even in the ocean, I guess I'm actually here now. I guess you could consider the Baltic Sea and the Mediterranean. But anyway, Eurovision, great.
Now, here's a crucial question. Now, as I understand it, Australians are regarded as, for Eurovision purposes, they're regarded as honorary Europeans, and Australia has actually had an entrant in past years. Is that correct?
Well, Australia actually has an entrant every year now.
Right.
So we are officially part of Eurovision, which is something that makes absolutely zero logical sense to anybody European, but is completely self-evident and obvious to anybody Australian. Of course we're in Eurovision. Of course we are.
Well, you're a former colony, so I guess that makes sense. But the real question is, now that you're an expat in Sweden, are you rooting for your home team, or are you rooting for the team, the competitor of your current country of residence?
That's a good question, actually. Like this year, Sweden actually won the Eurovision, which therefore means next year's Eurovision is going to come here to Sweden. Because Sweden puts in such an effort into, you know, the whole kind of Melody Festival and Eurovision culture, that, and also a very, very strong sort of melodic tradition, I suppose, just traditionally here in Sweden, you know, singing and the singing melody is something that is very, very deeply ingrained in Swedish culture and society. So if, for these reasons, Sweden very often tends to win Eurovision. And once again, this year we've won. The Australian entry this year was very good, I thought. And therefore, it was sort of I think I was straddling the two, like it's a win-win situation. I don't really mind whoever wins, as long as it's not the UK.
Well, there's no danger of that this year, but it's interesting how you said we won, referring to Sweden, and had Australia won, you would have probably said we won, referring to Australia.
Right.
So it seems like you have kind of floating loyalty that's dynamic, if you will, and adjustable to where you are.
Yeah, exactly. Let's call it flexible. The thing is that like in all seriousness, you know, Eurovision, the actual the concept of it is just great. I mean, you know, it's harmless. It's probably maybe 10 or 20% about the music. So that is something very, very important to consider when you listen. I mean, all of the people listening to the Game Audio Hour here are musicians. And so, you know, I'm sure a lot of people, especially the Europeans amongst our listening audience, are probably shaking their heads thinking, oh, geez, this is just embarrassing. Eurovision is just awful. Well, I mean, it's important to view it in the context of what it is. You know, it's just harmless, fun entertainment. And it's very little of it is about the music. And most of it is about the image and the spectacle and just the bizarre sort of circus nature of it and the wonderful sort of slightly veiled, subtle political aspects of it. And there are certain countries in Europe that take it very seriously, like Sweden and the other Scandinavian countries. And there are certain countries that don't take it seriously, for example, like Germany and the UK. It's a good thing too, because I think if Germany and the UK sent their absolute best top cutting-edge indie musicians to Eurovision, they would just wipe the floor, the competition clean every single time. And so just because the general talent of music, the level of music in these countries is so high, so it's probably a good thing that they don't take it that seriously. That's just clarifying my comment just a moment ago when I said as long as it's not the UK who wins. But anyway, sometimes you do find some nuggets in there amongst the sort of, there's these typical cliches that pop up in Eurovision, like, okay, here's the kind of semi-traditional ethnic one, and here's the power ballad, and here's the sort of soft metal one. There's sort of these cliches that come up every time. And then sometimes in amongst that, you find some real gems. For your information, this year, my pick for the hidden gem would be Serbia, which was a young musician called Luke Black. Generally, Eurovision songs, they're produced by, like, you know, 6 or 7 people, and you kind of wonder, like, what do they all do in producing this song? In the case of Luke Black's song, the Serbia entry, it was just him, and he's got going for him a real cool sort of 90s industrial vibe with some extremely dexterous, incredible choreography for his performance, and just overall just a very standout, unique artistic concept behind the whole package, because you have to consider the whole package in the case of Eurovision. So yes, if you are curious, check out the semi-final performance of Serbia's entry from Luke Black. And I mentioned that it's the semi-final performance. He was in the final, but the final performance was not quite as good as the semi-final. Anyway, shall we discuss game audio, Mike?
I guess we should get around to that.
Yeah. So before we get into some meaty discussion topics, I would like to put in a quick word for we have some more, I don't know, musically or workflow philosophical based conversations coming up later in the show today. But before getting into that, just a quick mention to my plugin company of the week. You know where I'm going, because I've on our internal Game Audio Hour Discord, I've been like mentioning this several times this week.
But, oh, yes.
Oh, boy. PSP, man. PSP. Good old PSP. You remember them? They're still in business.
I have one of their reverbs, I think, because of your enthusiastic endorsement and doubtless some kind of sale was happening too.
Yeah. I mean, that's PSP is, if you don't know who PSP are, then they're a Polish company and they've been around for a very long time. I think actually they were some of the very, actually, I don't really know that, but I know that they've been around for a really long time and way from the early years of VST development. Arguably their most famous and classic plugin is called Vintage Warmer, which I actually don't own, but I do own a lot of their other products. And yes, the aforementioned reverb that I convinced you to buy is the 2445, which is an EMT plate reverb emulation, which is algorithmic. So it's not an impulse, like a convolution-based reverb. Man, it's just been, it's like twice this week on this project that I'm working on, I've gone through, you know, five or six other reverbs just chasing the perfect sound. And then I come down the list to PSB 2445 and yep, there it is. That's it. Perfect. Absolutely perfect. That's happened twice this week. And that's up putting it up against some stiff competition of the likes of LX480 and the Valhalla Vintage Vintage Verb and Valhalla Room and Valhalla Plate and Tai Chi. And what other ones did I put up against? The SSL Flex Verb. And yeah, like all of these, just nope. Sorry, not quite there. And then put on that 2445 and that's it. And I have to just say that I really love it when plugins have a real sort of, yeah, versatility is great, but when a plugin has a real character to it, where it doesn't do everything, but it does a few things extremely well, it just means that, I don't know, it really helps with that, you know, what do you call it? The choice paralysis that we have, I shouldn't speak for everybody, but people like me who have far too many plugins, it really helps with that because, you know, you can just go directly to the sound that you want because you know that's what it does and it does it perfectly. Do you have many plugins that you would categorize in such a way?
That's an interesting question. And I'm not sure, maybe BX Opto, thanks to your enthusiasm, speaking of Alex endorsements of reverbs. VX Opto remains my go-to most of the time when I want kind of an opto compression sound. Reverb-wise, I'm probably not as sophisticated or as fussy as you, so I tend to stick to a few fairly flexible, like I've got one that I use for algorithmic sound and the other one that I use for convolution, and that takes care of 90% of my needs. But that said, I know exactly what you're talking about. And in the heat of a project with a deadline, it's sometimes easier to grab a plugin. Maybe it's modeled after some existing hardware, or maybe it just has a very well-defined personality that has a well-defined personality and know what you're getting. You know, it's like being able to grab for something on your desk and know exactly what it is and not have to really dig into configuring it. I've got like most, I know I'm talking about compressors instead of reverb, but the analogy applies. I've got the Fab Filter compressor and it has all these emulation modes and, you know, you can put it into opto mode, you can put it into all these other things, but I never do that. I always, if I want like, you know, an opto compressor, I grab an opto compressor. And I imagine this is very analogous to what you're describing with reverbs. You know, you just want to have a thing with a voice and just know that it's good at that thing.
Yeah, exactly right. And another PSP plugin which kind of falls into this category is PSP Old Timer, speaking of compressors. And that is also that one. I think it was actually the very first plugin that I ever bought was PSP Old Timer. That's also absolutely fantastic. And that was another PSP product that this week I just sort of, oh, yeah, Old Timer. I remember this one. I just break it up and see how it sounds now compared to all the other, you know, junk that I've amassed over the years. And like, I mean, they don't call it Old Timer for a reason. It's more like Old Faithful. It's amazing. It's just fantastic. Anyway, I would imagine that in your case and in Vince's case, because you work a lot with instrument libraries and sample libraries, I imagine that's a specific case where, you know specifically if you want this kind of bassoon sound or this sort of string ensemble sound or these, I don't know, a certain timbre of brass sounds, you'll have your go-tos that you go to. Am I right?
Yeah, but they tend to be presets within a given reverb plugin rather than different reverb plugins. At least that's how I approach it.
I'm talking about the actual sample libraries though. Like, you know, if you want, you go to Spitfire for this, or you go to, like, you know, Orchestral Tools for that, or to Symphobia for this, or stuff like that.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, exactly. Different sample libraries, even within the same instrument category, will tend to have their own personality or flavor strengths. And yes, for a given purpose, I might grab string library X versus Y. You're absolutely right.
So I guess that begs the next question then, and we might have talked about this before, but it's probably worth coming back to it. Templates. So I suppose, you know, often you see strongly recommended by people, you know, especially if you're working with an orchestral kind of texture, if you, it's only so much easier to kind of lay out into a template all of those favorites that you have, so that when you come to, you know, sit down to compose something with an orchestral texture, it's just so much easier just to hit the ground running and get straight into it instead of fiddling around with, you know, remembering which violin library sounds like this, or which flute library sounds like that, or what your best solo trumpet is, all of that. Having it all laid out in a template means you can just hit the ground running, and that's a very, very common recommendation. But in your case, I assume that you work with a template or not, or how are things for you there?
Well, it's funny that you mentioned this topic, because for years I've been trying to resist the idea of the template. And for some of our listeners who may not know exactly what we're talking about, typically a template is just a project file in your DAW that has a large number of instruments preloaded into it and maybe some frequently used plugins. And the idea is you just load all that stuff up and you don't have to manually load sounds in the heat of the deadline of the project. So I have resisted this for years, and I've been looking for alternative methods of doing the same thing. And they've, in some cases, dipped into specific functionality of Logic. And in other cases, I've literally come up with organized lists of patches in outlining software that I could just refer to and organize freely as I saw fit. My beef with templates were twofold. The twofold beef, if you will. The first issue is I imagined if you've got 500 instruments in your template, that it would be a daunting wait just to load the template. And I was very concerned about workflow and just the speed involved. And I also didn't want to set up something like Vienna Ensemble, where I could instantiate the template in another app that would just persist whether or not my main DAW was running. But that in itself introduces a number of inefficiencies. You know, when your DAW has to communicate with something else, and that something else requires configuration, you kind of lose the workflow advantages of the template. So I didn't want to do that either. But finally, I came around, and I came around because in the case of Logic, there are a couple of features of the DAW that make template use very easy. The first one, and for me the most critical, is I believe it's called inactive tracks. But the idea is if you load a project and it has tracks with instruments instantiated, but there's nothing for those tracks to do. There's no MIDI data on it. There's no automation. Logic will, at your discretion, essentially load a placeholder for that instrument, but not load the instrument. So you can see it as if it were loaded, but only when you actually click on that track or record on it will it actually go through the process of loading the digital instrument or the plugins or the reverbs or whatever you have on that channel strip. So for me, this was a huge game changer because it meant I can put 500 or 1,000 instruments on my template, but it'll load almost instantly. So that really helped. Let's see. The other concern I had was just eternal scrolling of the spotless mind, where I even if I had my template organized beautifully according to section and family and however else, I was worried that my sequences would consist of tracks that would be vertically very displaced from one another. So I'd either be scrolling all the time because, you know, the top instrument of my template is instrument one and the bottom instrument is 960, and you can visualize the problem.
Right.
And I didn't want to sit there dragging tracks constantly. And what I found was really handy is that Logic has a key command that will let you hide or unhide all of those inactive tracks.
Okay.
So you can essentially make them disappear or reappear with a key press. So for me, that made the whole template approach ergonomic. And I've been using it, and it's really, I'm just feeling remorse for not having done this years ago, honestly.
That's cool. That's cool. Your logic is recently, as in a few days ago now, I think as of the recording of this show, they had a new version come out, which features a very, very comprehensive iPad version of Logic, right? It's very fully featured, so I hear.
Yeah, it'd be more accurate to say they released an iPad version and also a incremental bug fix version of desktop Logic that also supported the iPad version.
I see. Do you see them converging at some point in the future where it's basically one Logic version across both platforms?
Well, you'll never be able to have... I should be careful what I say because the future is evasive, but I don't see in the immediate future a literal convergence where the same code base is used for both. Mm. I don't think the operating systems have converged on one another quite that closely. It's more of an incremental process where it seems that every year Apple is doing something to unify iOS and its variants and macOS.
Mm.
But what I think is happening, and I will venture a modest prediction of the future. Future selves can go back and see how I did. I think the Logic team has been working on a pretty substantial new version, and that of the desktop app, I should say, the main Logic, and that the iPad was this parallel thing that utilized some of the ideas that I think we're also going to find in the next desktop iteration. I think the interface will look more like this new iPad interface while being appropriate for a non-touch driven operating system. This may be wishful thinking on my part because there are certain features in Logic that I have just been waiting for so long. And I keep, every time they release a new version, my hopes go up and then they're dashed again. And I'm just hoping that all of those things will be addressed in one gargantuan monster release.
Mm. I wonder what they're going to call it because they've done, it's been Logic Pro and they've also had Logic Express, I believe, before. There was like the cut down version of Logic called Logic Express.
That was a long time ago. That was pre-Apple, I believe. That was kind of the eMagic days.
Oh, really? Okay. And then, what's it going to be called? Logic One, of course.
That would follow the trend, right? Exactly.
Or Logic, because there's Studio One. Maybe that's not going to work. It'd be Logic Live. No, that's no good, is it? I don't know. Anyway, good luck to them.
Yeah. I'll tell you, this is actually another topic in its own right, but the iPad version of Logic has a distinction from the desktop version, which scares me a little, and that is subscription pricing.
Ah.
It is modest, but it's there, and this is the first time Logic in any form has had subscription pricing.
Mm.
And I am nervous that along with the giant hypothesized new version of desktop Logic, we're going to see a shift to subscription pricing, which is kind of my bane. That's kind of my, I have a prejudice against it. So I'm fingers crossed that that does not happen. Do we know of any major DAW right now that has subscription pricing?
Well, there's Pro Tools. Pro Tools is a subscription-based DAW, I'm pretty sure. I don't know. I don't use Pro Tools. I think Bitwig is technically subscription, but it's a bit of an unusual subscription in that in the case of Bitwig, you have to pay for it regularly only if you want updates. But if you stop paying for it, then you basically sit on the version that you have and technically you own it. As long as you're happy with the functionality and the stability of one version of Bitwig, then you can stop paying regularly and just keep on that version. And sadly, of course, regardless of if you're using a Mac or Windows, operating system changes will eventually mean that you're going to have to update at some point. So it's sort of it is basically a subscription, but it's just sort of disguised as not being one. Let me think, other subscription-based DAWs. I think that might be it, just Pro Tools and Bitwig, and I don't think of any of the others. I'm not really sure. I'm not sure about some of the other, Reason or Traction, Waveform, or any of those, but subscription thing, that's a conversation perhaps for another time when we haven't just filled up half an episode talking about gear. Just as a quick aside there before we move on, templates. I actually don't use templates myself. I do have a basic template that has, I mean, as you know, my main kind of wheelhouse is synth-based stuff. And I have a template that I use that has some, you know, has a reverb and delay bus set up, as well as some a drum setup with the Tal drum plugin, which I use. That's just basically routing off, you know, 8 of the pads from Tal drum into 8 separate outputs with a group to group them all together, as well as some drum bus effects that also group together into a drum sum. So that's all in a template, just basically to save me time having to set it up every time. It's less about avoiding, you know, choice paralysis. No, is that the right term for it? Decision paralysis? Is that it?
Decision paralysis is more common, but I think we know what you're getting at.
Yeah, yeah. Not choice paralysis, but decision paralysis. But actually, an approach that I like to do, being mainly working with synths, is that I'll often take in a single project, in the sort of pre-production phase of a project, when I'm just exploring ideas, what I'll actually be doing is going through all of the different synthesizers that I like to use and basically choosing one, and then, or one or two, and then I'll try and stick to only using that for almost all of the project, for everything except for percussion. And the point of doing that is simply reducing that decision and paralysis of, you know, I need this, I've got this kind of sound in my head and I want to get that sound. And if it's a sound that like a lot of these soft synths and hardware synthesizers can do, then I'll just sit there for ages just trying to find the right one instead of actually programming something properly. And so I've found that a really good way to help myself be more efficient and save myself from that kind of conundrum is to pick one synth and use that for the whole project. This works very well for me. And obviously, if you do it that way, then you don't really need a template, because every project is going to have a different, you know, main synthesizer that you'll be using anyway. So that's my approach to templates.
It's interesting how much that contrasts to what you were describing before about reverbs, where you liked having different things with different discrete identities for different sounds. And here you're describing an approach where you have a sufficiently flexible synth plugin to do everything. So that becomes a explore every channel of this one complicated, versatile thing, rather than have a lot of little things that are all specialized.
Well, actually not, because one of the reasons that I do this is that I do find that synthesizers, even the ones that are, you know, supposed to be versatile, they do have, you do fall into a certain way of using them for a certain kind of sound. So I'll often be choosing a synthesizer specifically because it has a certain sound and a character to it, which through that pre-production exploratory process, you know, I will decide somehow suits the timbre of the music that I'm going for. So it is basically, again, still the same thing, even with the very versatile soft synths, like, for example, Phase Plant or Yuhi Zebra or Arturia's Pigments. These are kind of, you know, one-stop shop, do-everything kind of synths. Even with them, I do find that they have a very specific sound to them and a specific workflow that sound kind of informs. And therefore, that would be a reason to choose them for a specific project over anything else. So it is still the same kind of thing of learning these things to the point of having a character there, which I can then pull out with a specific purpose in mind.
So the issue is really defining the artistic parameters of a given project more narrowly, which allows you to eliminate some choices and then use a particular thing that has a particular personality, rather than have the entire arsenal constantly calling out at you and competing for your favor.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think I just, maybe I romanticize it a bit too much, but I do like the idea that these tools have a character to them and they have a flavor to them. And you know, when I choose them for a project, I'm choosing them because that's somehow or other, for me at least, that flavor or that personality is meaningful for the artistic objectives of the project. So as I said, I realize and I fully admit that I probably overcomplicating this whole thing and making it much more romantic than it needs to be. But yeah, you know, we've got to have some fun sometimes, right, Mike?
I agree. Or to at least we have to characterize something we do as fun when it might not actually be in practice.
That's right. That's right. You know, one thing that I was thinking this week, I promise this is the end of our gear talk for today's episode, but just one last thing that's been on my mind is that I've had the pleasure of the past few weeks of just focusing purely on making music for various projects that I'm doing, which is it's a rarity for me because often I'm having to kind of be producer and, you know, running a business and all this boring stuff at the same time. Being able to focus on music means that I've been basically in Cubase every day, and Cubase is great. I love Cubase. However, I was sort of thinking the other day, it's kind of a shame that using Cubase doesn't feel more like I'm orchestrating an instrument, like I'm using an instrument. I'm using this instrument to express my idea. In the case of Cubase, perhaps because of its utilitarian roots, it feels much more like a tool as opposed to a musical instrument. And that is definitely not the case with a tool like Renoise Tracker. Being a tracker, it is obviously that the whole paradigm is completely different. How you approach entering music and arranging music and thinking about music is very, very different with a tracker. So for me personally, when I'm using Renoise, it feels much more like Renoise is the instrument and I'm playing an instrument. Whereas Cubase, it feels like, you know, I'm building a chair with a screwdriver and a drill and a saw and a, you know, a block of sandpaper, and it just feels much more, I don't know, clinical. Whereas Renoise feels really like I'm actually playing an instrument, even though actually what's happening is the same thing, where I'm just sequencing synthesizers and effects and stuff inside a DAW. Somehow it feels much more like playing an instrument. Because you've been using Logic for a really long time, does Logic at this point feel like an instrument to you or a tool?
No, I think it's more along the lines of how you've described Cubase for me. I think that instrument quality that you're describing, this is great, we get to tie together all our topics today, is a function of a particular DAW or a particular tool being specific in its focus. Because if we think of musical instruments, you know, other than keyboard synthesizers, they all are exactly that. They're a particular entity that makes a particular sound, or a family of sounds like in a guitar that are activated by the similar mechanic. And I think if a DAW is something like Logic or Cubase, where it's just evolved over the years to handle any conceivable situation, it becomes less specifically focused interface-wise for any one particular thing. So that's what gives it that tool feeling that you're describing. And whereas if you have typically like a younger, more focused and specific DAW, maybe Bitwig or maybe Ableton, I'm guessing those have more of that instrument-like quality because you're trying to do fewer things and the interface is set up to facilitate those things. Ellipsis, just like an actual musical instrument.
Obviously Bitwig and Ableton Live are probably slightly exceptional there because they both have live performance modes. Live actually, you know, it originally, that's all it was. It was the live performance side of it before it introduced the traditional horizontal scrolling DAW kind of approach. But they obviously are slightly exceptional because they were specifically made for live performance. And Bitwig as well has all of its routing and procedural stuff and all of the kind of Max4 live style functionality all built into Bitwig's whole infrastructure. So that's also one that I guess feels like an instrument. The only other kind of, let's say, legacy DAW, as in as old as Cubase, Logic, and trackers, the only other one that I've found that brings a similar kind of quality to Renoise is feeling like I'm playing an instrument is probably FL Studio. And obviously FL Studio is a very, I don't know if you've ever used FL Studio before. Have you, Mike?
I have watched some tutorials, but I've never put my hand on it.
Okay. I wonder actually how many of our listeners out there are FL Studio users. I'd be really curious to know. If we were doing this on YouTube, I'd say leave us a comment to let us know whether you use FL Studio. Leave us a comment on Twitter or wherever if you do actually use FL Studio, because FL Studio it's really cool. It's very, very different. It's so different that like all of the standard sort of approaches that you find are consistent with almost every other DAW, except Renoise, which is totally different. They're all quite different in FL Studio, and you really feel like you're using something from another planet. And you know, this is that strong feeling that, okay, this is going to take a lot of getting used to, but you can see that's why people who start with FL Studio tend to stick with it. And it also has that similar quality of feeling more like an instrument than a sort of do-it-all, ultra-versatile tool.
You know, there is, because I love this topic, actually, and there's one experience I've had that I think matches what you're describing.
Okay.
It's not with a DAW per se, but it's with notation software, first with Sibelius and then now with Dorico. And I find that when I'm using them specifically as compositional tools, as opposed to I need to make a part for this player tool, it does take on that quality of feeling kind of like an instrument. Mm. And I think it's the combination of, you know, the interface is essentially music notation. So for me, that plugs it into a certain, I'll say, mode of working. It's very analogous to when I've got, you know, a pencil and paper and I'm writing music that way. But I feel like the method of interaction when I'm throwing notes on the digital page is more akin to what you're describing than when I'm working with Logic, which is more cerebral. I think it's interesting that the type of music creation software whose interface paradigm is an emulation in some ways of traditional music input, you know, notes on paper, is the one that for me takes on that quality.
Mm. Maybe it might be something to do with flexibility of workflow and approach. You know, when you've got tools like Logic and Cubase that are built around basically allowing you to use them however you want, you can record audio, you can record MIDI, you can, you know, pencil in a clip and start clicking away on a piano roll. You can do step input. You can, you know, there's just however you want to work, you can do it. Whereas tools like Renoise and Dorico are very, very specific in making you work in a certain way. And I guess if you are used to working in that way for some reason, like in the case of Dorico, if you are brought up in a tradition of notating down music in order to write it, or in the case of Renoise, if you're some crazy guy who has his head still back in the nostalgia of the 90s and the demo scene, like me, and you know you've been using trackers literally since those days, like I have, then that being forced into that approach feels like a very natural thing. And then only having that approach, because Renoise is not really very good in any other approach. It's hard to record MIDI by playing on a keyboard. You end up just inputting it the old-fashioned way, as in typing on your QWERTY keyboard. It dictates the approach for you, which therefore, like an instrument, it's not as if you can just go to a violin and approach playing the violin how you want. I guess you can, but if you want to play actual violin music, you'd probably best be doing, you know, good violin technique. Just in the same way, if you want to write music with Dorico, then you're going to need to do it in Dorico's way. It's something about that lack of flexibility of approach.
I'm inclined to agree. And thinking back a little bit, my earliest formative music writing experiences happened on very limited 16-bit audio apps, on the Amiga primarily, a little bit on the Commodore, that's how old I am, but mostly on the Amiga. And I remember using like these proto-DAWs or proto-music notation apps like Sonix or Deluxe Music. Yeah. These were even more, obviously more limited than their descendants today, But when using them, I felt most in tune with the music creation process, where the app became transparent. Mm. And there was almost this direct transfer of music ideas into reality through a very, very simple app. Mm. The cost being, of course, I had to limit myself to the palette that was offered sonically by these tools. Mm. Like Sonix was this app that had, you know, up to 4 voices, which at the time was reckoned high tech, and you had a very limited number of instruments at your disposal. So you memorized them and you knew what to use them for. And there was very little friction between the interface and the creative process. Mm. I think I've been trying to reclaim that experience my whole life and have never really gotten close to that mind meld between thought and music creation, you know, except when I'm sitting at a piano. That's the only thing analogous. So I support your theory that limitations of input paradigm are the thing or part of the thing that gives this zen-like blending between music creation and the tool.
I think you've just summed it up perfectly there. You know, the idea that the tool becomes transparent and it's a direct conduit between you and the sound, that is exactly how I feel when I'm using Renoise. And the tricky part is just like, you know, I'm a bass player, so I play bass guitar. And yeah, I've been playing bass guitar for whatever it is, 35 years or something, and I feel very comfortable in expressing ideas very quickly and fluidly and fluently on the bass. But I fully acknowledge that the bass guitar is not an instrument that is suitable for absolutely every single musical purpose. Of course not. That's ridiculous. You know, it's like saying, yeah, okay, you know, the flute is there. There are certain things that the flute can do extremely well, and there are certain things that it's not really, I mean, it can get by, but it's just not really going to be able to handle so well. And in the same way, like using Renoise feels like an instrument in that it's exactly the same thing. It feels to me, because I'm used to it, perhaps it's a total one-to-one connection between me and the music. And that is such a liberating kind of feeling. But then at the same time, just like bass guitar or a flute or whatever, this workflow and this approach isn't going to be flexible for absolutely everything. And so, you know, having something like Cubase, which just feels, yeah, that there, it's definitely not transparent. There's this huge layer in between me, and then I interface with this tool to produce this sound. And I guess that explains that distance that I feel, which is, yeah, I don't know. I did doing it every day the past few weeks. It's been kind of boring, to be honest. Like I sort of long for that, you know, direct approach, even though Renoise isn't going to be the best choice for doing all kinds of music. I think you've just helped me convince myself that the next song for our project, I should just say, well, you know what? Screw it. I'm just going to do it all in Renoise and have some fun.
I thought you were going to say do it all on electric bass.
Yeah, that's right. That would be a challenge.
Although it might be an interesting challenge, maybe if not for an entire project, but maybe one cue, provided, you know, it made sense. But, you know, you could do quite a bit with an electric bass if you're allowed to use processors.
Yeah, it's an interesting discussion, this, isn't it? And I think because all of us in our industry, we all use DAWs, and that's just part of our, you know, whether you're in sound design or whether you're in music or, you know, even if you're a voice actor or doing editing work or anything like this, you know, we're all here using DAWs. And yeah, I would ask listeners to ask yourself, like, how transparent do you think your DAW is? And is there anything you can do about that? Like, if it's not transparent, would you rather be using something else? Is there something else that kind of suits you so much better, that kind of pushes you into a certain approach that feels much more direct? But actually, speaking of Dorico, just a new version was released just a few days ago, wasn't it? Dorico 5?
Yeah, Dorico 5 was released. I haven't yet upgraded because I tend to use Dorico with short, focused, intense periods rather than on an ongoing basis. So I usually wait till I need to use it again, and then I grab the latest version. But there are a couple of interesting features. I feel like this release is very oriented towards playback features and the kind of ways in which Dorico overlaps with a DAW. You know, that's that aspect to it. And I think of notation software, Dorico is probably among the more sophisticated in having DAW-like qualities, particularly since Dorico 4. That said, there are a few little things that I find very inviting from a usability perspective. The one I'm most excited about, and this is extremely nerdy, is that if you, let's say you've got a key command to select a particular note duration, like for, I think I've got like 3 on my keyboard turns a note into a quarter note. That's just the way I have it configured. If you tap that key twice quickly, it gives you the dotted version of that note value. So that doesn't sound like a lot of brilliance, but actually the ergonomic benefit of doing that, I think, is tremendous because it makes this very commonly used compositional decision to be, to tie it right back to our topic, transparent. And we might even start to automate that process in the sense of human psychology and not even, it might even feel like you're just willing a note to become a dotted version of that note. So that one sort of second tier feature got me really excited because I think it would push Dorico further in the direction that we were just talking about, having that instrument-like quality.
Yeah, that's one thing I have to give a whole lot of credit to Steinberg for. I don't know to what extent the Cubase team talks with the Dorico team and whether or not they share the same UX department, but sometimes I pinch myself with Cubase to remind myself that this is the one of the elder statesmen of this style of DAW. Like it is so old, and I believe actually Cubase was the very first DAW on the Atari ST to feature this style of horizontally scrolling music.
Interesting.
It was actually the very this basic approach to DAWs where you have this horizontal, you know, cells that you click on and then opens up some notes and then you close it and then, you know, you can group that. That allows you to make these clips and then allows you to repeat them and move them around, et cetera, et cetera. This basic approach to DAWs, the Steinberg Cubase was the very first one to do that. And, or is that true? Because I'm just trying to think on the Amiga, did like MusicX and Bars and Pipes, I know they were actually around, I think, they came out just after Cubase did on the Atari ST. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But the point is that sometimes I pinch myself with Cubase to remind myself that this thing is so old and it has such a long legacy behind it. The reason that I find that hard to believe is because there are so many sort of little UX touches in Cubase that are just really smart. And it's like, you would think, like, looking right at you, Photoshop, you would think that one of these software package of such a long legacy would be so heavily weighed down with all the decades of features and workflow approaches that it has to support now, and yet not. And yet, Cubase feels very easy and quick to learn, and easy and intuitive, and just quite well designed. So this that you mentioned here, like double pressing a key to turn it into the dotted equivalent. That's a very, I don't know, it feels very Steinberg to me somehow.
Yeah, I don't know to what extent, I don't know which direction the flow of information is, or inspiration, I should say, whether the Dorico people are giving ideas to their home base team of Steinberg or vice versa. I know that Dorico did adapt expression maps and implement those. So that's obviously a case of cross-fertilization of technology. I think there has been a running speculation that at one point, Dorico and Cubase might become very tightly integrated, where one could effectively be the real-time notation editor of the other, allowing a kind of Uber mutation. I think I was saying music notation at the same time. Kind of an Uber music experience where there's a fluid back and forth between the notation paradigm and the DAW-based kind of piano roll paradigm. And I would be very excited to see things move in that direction, but it hasn't quite happened yet.
So I think the big question that I'm really wanting to ask you at this point, Mike, is Dorico has a new version. Excellent. You use Dorico. Great. You've mentioned that music notation as a form of creating music is what comes very naturally to you. So the obvious question now is, Mike, will there ever be a time when Dorico or an equivalent replaces Logic and you're only doing work in Dorico? Would that not be like the perfect solution, and you have something that's easy to use, it's very capable, and it's able to give you that feeling of, you know, the tool melting away and it's just you and the music? Like, is Dorico that platform that could potentially be the center of your setup?
I don't think Dorico on its own will ever be a substitute for a dedicated DAW in the traditional sense. From the standpoint of music production, if I knew the rest of my career was going to be 100% writing for live musicians, then I might find myself going in that direction if Dorico's support for kind of real-time input and DAW-like functionality got sufficiently sophisticated. But at the end of the day, I suspect that I'll be writing production. The music I write will also include some degree of production, meaning probably digital instrumentation or synthetic instrumentation. So from that point of view, I doubt that Dorico will ever win me over 100%. That said, I do try to be aggressive in experimenting in using Dorico as a compositional tool, sometimes with the understanding that I will then export the results back to Logic for prettying up and for massaging and so forth. But there's really a difference in how I write when I'm working with notation, be it in Dorico or pencil and paper, than when I write in a DAW. And sometimes when I'm listening to soundtrack albums, film or games, I'll hear a cue and think, yeah, that kind of contrapuntal complexity and interestingness, that probably was not done through real-time input on a keyboard into a DAW. That was probably the result of some kind of static composition process like a notation software or good old-fashioned pencil and paper.
Yes. Yes, that is exactly how I feel about when I listen to the music that I've written in Renoise versus what I'm doing in Cubase. That's exactly what I feel. And it's very disappointing. That is that, like, I listen to the Renoise stuff and I think, oh, that is so much more interesting. Like, when I just find that the stuff that I'm doing when I'm actually typing in the music in Renoise or the old-fashioned way is so much more interesting than what I produce when I'm working in Cubase, just because I'm not a very good keyboard player. I mean, I can play enough to sort of, you know, play in a melody or obviously playing chords and stuff like that, but not to the point of being virtuosic in the way that, say, Vince is. So it's often a case of, you know, squinting at the piano roll and clicking and dragging and stuff, which is far less efficient for me than typing on a QWERTY keyboard in Renoise. And so I always find that the music that I make in Renoise is so much more interesting and experimental and closer to what I want. Again, I guess this is what gives that feeling of it being like an instrument for me. So, yeah, maybe if Dorico... In Dorico, how do you input? Do you input by clicking on the score, or do you actually play it in, or do you have that choice?
They give you quite a few choices with respect to how you want to input music. There are a couple of keyboard-based approaches. You can do step entry with a MIDI keyboard, and you can physically drag eighth notes from the side of the screen onto the staff if you really like that kind of direct manipulation of graphic entities. What I find works very well for me is I will use the drag a note onto the staff for the very first note in a phrase, and then I will use it's almost like the ASDW commands for like a PC shooter game, a very small number of keyboard commands to do a whole lot. Mm. In particular, there's the... I have it bound to R. I don't know what the default key binding is, but R for me in Dorico is repeat. So if there's let's imagine there's like a quarter note on C5, and then I hit R, I get another quarter note on C5, and then I hit number keys to change the duration, and then I hold the arrow key up or down to move it on the staff. And a rapid iteration through these specific key commands, R for a new note, arrow keys for vertical placement, and then the shortcuts with the numbers for duration, and a couple of other frequent flyers like T for tie and other stuff like that. That for me is the speedy and effective, I keep saying paradigm, but it is a great word, paradigm for notation entry. And that for me specifically creates that unity of tool and music creation that we were discussing earlier.
Yeah, that sounds so cool. That sounds a lot like, obviously the keys are different, but the speed and the sort of the enthusiasm in your voice just now as you were describing that process, it mirrors how I would describe inputting notes into Renoise on a QWERTY keyboard. It's just it's the same kind of thing. It's just fast and quick. So maybe the moral of this story is that, we should all be using QWERTY keyboards instead of MIDI controllers, maybe.
Or if we were to generalize a little bit, I think as music creators who are indebted to some kind of software tool, we should try to pick a tool that is as simple as the task will allow and has some kind of input method that will plug in directly to our soul and make the interface transparent or as transparent as possible.
Mm.
Now, it might be the case that someone like Vince, who is just a stunning pianist, thinks so naturally of the piano as an input device that for him, real-time input into a DAW might be as natural and fluid and effortless as the more notation-driven approach I use is to me.
Mm.
It really depends on your skill set. And for you, you've got your matrix-esque bonding with numeric data where you're looking at the numbers and, you see symphony. It's all a matter of training and overtraining, to use a little cognitive science. And it may differ from person to person. So that's why I think we want to generalize this advice. Whatever is natural for you and makes the UI transparent, try to work in that system.
Sage advice. And with that, apologies to anybody who was hoping for something other than a gear-focused conversation this episode. let's close things up with our customary conspicuous consumption. So this is the part of the show where we check out what we've been listening to, playing, reading, watching, enjoying since the last episode. So, Mike, what have you been consuming these past 2 weeks?
A newfound TV series that I'm really enjoying is Silo, which is an adaptation of a trilogy of books. I forgot the author's name, but sort of dystopian future sci-fi. And the first book in the series is Wool. It's a pretty decent adaptation in several senses. I think the visualization of the show, it's actually a rare case where the visualization of the show, the production design and the settings and the set pieces and the art, pretty closely matched what was in my imagination when I was reading the book.
Mm.
I really do like the score, which is, it has kind of the typical half organic, half synthetic sound that I think a lot of sci-fi TV has these days, but it's also very melodic and catches your interest. Like I've paid attention to the score more than a normal human being would. And I noticed the composer is very melodically inclined, and sometimes scenes will get a lot of emotional contour from just how the melody of a theme will interact with the action. So I approve of that approach, and I should have really looked up the composer's name so I could have given credit where credit is due. But Silo is a decent adaptation, so I recommend that.
That's cool. I think you might have mentioned Silo last time, but I think that at that stage you were just watching it and yet didn't have as much interesting thoughts on it. But that sounds something cool to check out.
For sure. How about yourself? What have you been playing or listening to lately?
I've actually been doing a little bit of a dive into 90s industrial music, somewhat inspired by Serbia's slightly industrial-tinted entry to Eurovision. I've been checking out a Belgian, 90s Belgian group called Front 242, who were very big back in the day. Yeah, I've never really given industrial music like industrial. I listen to industrial techno a lot, but not the sort of classic industrial music that much before. Beyond, you know, things like Nine Inch Nails and stuff like that. But Front 242 is a very kind of cut and dry, straight ahead industrial group. And yeah, it's been very, very interesting. It's interesting that back in those days, the very raw, unprocessed, aggressive sort of synthesizer sound of those industrial bands, I can remember back in those days was quite almost abrasive in its sort of rawness. Now, listening to it now, it sounds much more, what's the right word? Not so much commonplace, but it's like, okay, yeah, okay. It's industrial music, yeah. It's taken off some of that surprising, maybe even shocking nature of the music at the time back in the mid-90s when this stuff was around. It's like, oh, wow, like that's aggressive. Now it's like, oh, okay, yep, great, good work.
Yeah, it is funny how things that were once edgy become quaint over time.
Yeah, yeah, it's really good though. It's very very educational. I guess now with my love and knowledge of synthesizers and techno and stuff like that, listening to it now is also a very nice experience. It's very it's like, oh wow, that's what was going on in those days. That's cool. As with a lot of things from the 90s and the so-called golden era of techno, a lot of it sounds very fresh. Like it could be released yesterday and it would be, you know, charting Spotify playlists and stuff like that. So yeah, anyway, Front 242, that's what I've been rather conspicuously consuming.
That would be a great band to be the opening act for Level 42.
Ah, I see what you did there. Yes.
Thank you.
Indeed. So this has been episode whatever it was. 200 and what was it? 240. Let me just take a 244.
Oh, so close. But yes. You can almost have matched your band.
Yeah, that's right. Not 242. No, 244 of the Game Audio Hour. If you enjoyed what you heard today, please consider following us on Twitter at Game Audio Hour, which is the best place to keep up to date on all of our comings and goings in the game audio sphere, and also where we make announcements for new episodes. And be sure to subscribe to us on your, what does Vince always say, podcast purveyor of choice.
Yep.
So that we can stay up to something with the algorithm. I can't exactly remember what Vince's wonderful regular speech is, but something like that. In any case, this has been Game Audio Hour. I'm Alex May, and I've been joined by the magnanimous Michael Gordon Shapiro. And please be sure to tune in next time. Keep your eye on Game Audio Hour on Twitter, and give us a follow and a like and all of that. And we'll see you next time.
See you next time.